Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to a new episode of Good Trouble. Today I have a troublemaker of the highest order, the founder of one of the premier storytelling spaces and organizations here in the city, somebody who has put forth a new vision of what Boston is like. He's been essential in kind of telling the story of the Boston that we are right now. I am with my friend Darren Bascom of Proverb. How are you today?
Wow, Greg, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for the invitation, and this should be fun.
Yes, I've been looking forward to it. And listen, we are going to have some music talk because. Yeah. I know that's something, I feel like that's something that we connected with, and we just automatically, like, oh, you're one of my friends that if I talk to him, I want to know what you're listening to. Like, you and my other buddy, DJ ESQ, one of the first questions we ask each other when we see each other is, what are you listening to right now? So let's start off with that. What are you listening to right now?
Wow. Yeah, you know, it's, what am I listening to right now? Right now, I've been listening to the new No Name, and there's a track that she has with Jay Electronica, who I just think is a genius. And so I think that's amazing and worth checking out. I've been listening to, there's a new Bad, Bad, Not Good and Turnstile collaboration that also I just think is, and it's just an EP, but, you know, everything that they put out, I think, is always just, you know, hugely inventive and creative. I've been listening to a lot of Horace Silver over the last.
I'm not familiar with him.
Yeah, so Horace Silver was a sort of hard bop composer and pianist. I think originally from Cape Verde, and. And I'm working on like a personal project right now. So my dad passed last summer, and he was a Berklee College of Music grad and jazz composer and drummer. And after he graduated, we moved back to Bermuda, which, you know, was kind of a mixed bag. I think it was probably a better place to raise a family, but it was probably a terrible place to be a musician. But he would get up really early in the morning, like at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning, and compose. And, and so he's got like maybe 150 compositions that are for, you know, sort of mid-sized ensembles. Probably heard 15 of them in his lifetime. And so next week, I'm getting some of them recorded.
Really?
Yeah,
that's so incredible.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a really interesting story. So my dad had a major stroke about 8 years ago, and prior to having it, and I think that he knew something was up, because he had, left a suit that he really liked in a very conspicuous place, along with like his Masonic regalia, but had also pulled together a package of like 20 compositions. And so the top one is like labeled For Us, and then there's like songs for like my mom and my sister and my daughters, me, my ex-wife, and then also like arrangements of, you know, songs that he loved. And so it's a project that I've been working on with Bill Banfield, and
I know Bill. Jazz Urbane.
Yeah, and so some of the members of the Jazz Urbane Orchestra, though this, you know, doesn't require a full orchestra. Mm. So we're gonna rehearse and record some of what was inside of the package, but we're also gonna document the recording. And film that, and and perhaps try to make a short, you know. But it's kind of a cool project. I think it's it's a way of getting to know him in a way that, you know, I haven't, or up until now, you know. And musicians are really interesting because they hear things before the rest of us do.
Yes.
And, you know, and there's this app I keep on my phone. I don't know if I've ever told you about this. It's called WeCroak. And it's based on this like Tibetan philosophy where by embracing death on a regular basis, that it might actually change how you make decisions or how you even live, right? Like, you know, so many of us, you know, put things off or what have you. And so, you know, once a day, three times a day, seven times a day, whatever the frequency is that you want, it sends you a message about death or dying. And so when I had flown home to make arrangements for his homegoing, you know, as soon as I got cell phone service, you know, a bunch of text messages come in and a message from WeCroak. And I'm like, I can deal with the text later. But I open up WeCroak and it says, the goal in life isn't to live forever. It's to create things that do.
Wow.
And, you know, and I, and it's been one of these things that has kind of stuck with me ever since. It's also been, I think, something that's been really, you know, empowering in a lot of ways, you know, but, you know, I think it's a lot easier to create things that live forever if you're doing something creative. And, you know, and so I feel really lucky that we're able to make this happen. So
that's incredible. It is interesting to hear that phrase, you know, it's not to live forever, but to make things that do. And I think that that's something that you have done, you know, as you tell us this story, you're doing that personally, but you're also, you know, you're helping put your father's legacy so that he's doing it. And, but also you do that professionally with Proverb, you know what I mean? You are creating different narratives in what you do. How did you get into the work of that storytelling in the professional setting that you do?
Yeah. So I did a double major in design as an undergrad and really cut my teeth working for a firm that planned and produced permanent museum exhibits and aquariums and zoos and got to work on projects all over. So I got to work on things like the National Museum of Australia and got to work on the aquariums in Barcelona and in Taiwan and the American Jazz Museum, what's now the Museum of Pop in Seattle. And part of what's really interesting about that work, Greg, is that it's content driven. Right. So you start out by sitting across from someone like yourself who's super smart and, you know, will, you know, try to investigate a particular subject matter. And, you know, the reality is that you probably know too much about it. Right. So, like, how do we actually work with you to winnow it down to two or three things? And then, like, how do we figure out how to talk about those two or three things in a way that's meaningful to a 7-year-old and someone with a master's degree? And then how do we take that and turn it into a story? How do we take that story and then deploy it across all these different disciplines? So how do we get, you know, architects, lighting designers, filmmakers, industrial designers, docents, you know, to all tell the same story, right? And if you're able to do that successfully, you create environments that are immersive, that people walk into and believe, right? And it's no different from walking into the Apple store, right? You have a sense of what's supposed to happen, you know, when, you know, your device stops working, right? And sort of the promise of that brand. So I had managed to get a few things built that I had been playing a role in, you know, and the work is very academic, right? So you might work on a project, well, you know this from The Embrace. So you might work on a project for, you know, 3 years, 5 years, 7 years before it's built. And so I managed to get a couple of things built. The company had grown really quickly. There were rumors that there were going to be layoffs. And I approached the comptroller. It was a Friday afternoon. And I was like, hey, I heard that there are going to be layoffs. And she was like, oh, no, there's nothing to it. And I said, wow, I was wondering if that should change if you consider laying me off. And she says, really? And And I was like, yeah. And she says, well, come into my office. And so she pulls out a spreadsheet. There's my name. There's a number next to it. I was not in a management role. I wasn't negotiating anything. And she's like, this is what we're going to offer you. And I was like, cool. Do you think we can get to this kind of a number? And I just throw out a number. And she says, okay, talk to Joe and we'll get back to you on Monday. And I come in on Monday and she's like, Joe agreed to everything. You can finish up in 2 weeks. And I was like, cool. Can I have my computer? And she was like, oh yeah, cool. And so I sat up in my living room with like a business plan of like, do good work and try to find some more. And, you know, the thing that kind of gave me that, that sort of wolf ticket was, you know, I was always freelancing, you know, whenever I had a job, and it was a way of being able to build a portfolio that I had a little more control over. And so I had done a project, for an agency I used to intern at, out of Bermuda. It was for Bacardi. I think I was making $43,000 a year. This was like 26 years ago. And I made $8,000 in my nights and weekends over like 6 weeks. So it was like a lot of money to me. I think it was like the first time I had like $10,000 in the bank. And, you know, and so, you know, crazy me blows up his life. And, you know, and, you know, the first thing I did was like call that agency and let them know and ask if they had anything else for me to work on. And one thing kind of led to another. You know, it was, you know, in that first year as a freelancer, you know, managed to like work on what became a James Beard Award winning restaurant, you know, landed a couple of clients that were connected to the MIT Media Lab. And like, you know, and that's kind of what sort of put me on a path. I don't know if I ever really believed enough in in my own last name to really want to put that on the door. And so it was almost always, it was probably from like month two or three. And I just thought that, you know, if I was ever fortunate enough to work with other people, that it would just be easier if we called it something other than my first and last name. So.
Okay. Well, that's incredible. Like the idea that, you know, to just kind of strike out on your own. And I think that what made you decide that day, you know what, I'm going to ask to be laid off, volunteer to be laid off. What was kind of what was that drive? Was there a drive of independence? Was it even something that may have even been inspired by your father? Because I would imagine as a musician, there's a little bit of the freedom of being a musician. I mean, obviously there's a grind to it as well, but there's a freedom with that as well. Did that inspire you at all?
Oh yeah, I mean, that certainly inspired, and there were a lot of entrepreneurs in my family, you know, so like, I'm not a first generation entrepreneur. I'm a fourth generation entrepreneur. My great grandfather was a professional bell diver, you know, made his living doing that.
Like, wait.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in the Bascom line, there is a bell, a musician, a designer of the highest order, and a bell diver.
Yeah. So he was, he was like the first Bermudian bell diver on the island. And so he would do like underwater ship repair and, you know, did like marine construction, had 11 sons. Two daughters, clearly could have used a TV. and the lore in the family is that, like, you know, he wanted to make sure that none of them ever had to work for white people. And so was like pretty wily and, you know, was able to like start a few businesses. He had a lime kiln. He had a trucking business, you know, bought some property. You know, when I look at like that whole line of my grandparents, like, and his brothers, you know, like all those guys were independent. Like nobody, you know, nobody went to college, you know, but, you know, one might have, you know, might own a couple of taxis, you know, this one might have a trucking, you know, a trucking business or any of those things, you know. And so my grandfather was a fine cabinet maker and fine carpenter. And so that was his trade. But, you know, but so I think the idea of, you know, being able to, you know, to see a path forward that didn't necessarily require being in a corporate setting, I think was helpful. You know, in Bermuda, it's a very expensive place. And so, you know, everyone always has a side hustle, right? Like, and so that piece of it, I think, was also something that was fairly natural. You know, I would say that, you know, perhaps sort of the last piece of it was, or maybe the last two pieces of it, you know, one was, you know, certainly like the influence of hip hop and, you know, the idea of, you know, building Black-owned businesses, you know, a certain type of, you know, challenging of the status quo and like all of those things, like that stuff, I think was really kind of central to my coming of age, you know. And I would say that, you know, perhaps sort of, you know, and even looking at like filmmakers like Spike Lee or, you know, an architect like, or architects like Stalin Lee, you know, here in Boston, you know, like they were kind of the closest things that I could see when I was in college to where I was trying to go, you know? And so, so, you know, I think all of those seeds were kind of planted, you know, while I was still in school. I think when I then went into the workforce and working in design studios and the design industry and advertising industry, you know, is, you know, isn't diverse at all. And, mm-hmm. You know, and the numbers, you know, are still incredibly anemic. And, you know, and while I graduated with, you know, what would be arguably a pretty hot portfolio, I always felt like there was a lot of me that I was, that I wasn't able to bring into the environments that I was working in, you know. And so I could do this kind of a work or what have you, or, you know, the environments you were in, you know, almost everyone was listening to, you know, WFNX and, you know, alternative rock, and, you know, everyone wore black leather coats and Doc Martin boots, and, you know, mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, and
I am familiar with that era, sir.
Yeah. And like, and that wasn't my aesthetic at all. You know what I mean? Like, and or maybe that was part of my aesthetic, but it certainly wasn't all of my aesthetic. You know, and you know, and so you know, and so I would oftentimes like come in super early or hang out super late, you know, and work on things, you know, because like I could play the music I wanted to play, or you know, or you know, sort of develop projects, you know, more in an environment that was conducive to the type of work that I was looking to do. You know, so I think that like all of those things, although I probably couldn't name them at the time, you know, had an influence in helping me to get to a point to like, you know, take a chance on doing something else, you know, because I didn't necessarily, you know, love everything about the environments that I was working in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that makes it make more sense. Like when you add in that, the lineage that you're coming from mixed in with the hustler spirit from the era that you're growing up in, it only makes sense that you would kind of strike out on your own and kind of go into the world and be like, okay, well, I can see there's another way to do this, or I don't have to go and conform with what's out there. And I think that, you know, that same spirit of independence, or that same spirit of kind of seeing something else, is, I think it also informs, you can please tell me, this is outside looking in, it feels like that ability to kind of look outside the box informs the work that you've done. Like with the work that you did with the city of Boston around that campaign, you know, I know you've done that. You've done the stuff with the tourism in Bermuda. Like, there's a variety of those things. And even the identity work that you've, the brand identity work that you've done, like, you've done that with Embrace Boston. That's where you and I first became connected and got to know each other. And then you've also done that with the Boston Foundation. You've become one of the go-to people, definitely in the region and also nationally, when somebody wants to tell a different story or an updated story about themselves. You know, do you think those things kind of intertwined, that spirit of seeing something different along with the opportunities that you've been able to take advantage of?
Absolutely. Yeah. And also, like, being able to, you know, I think being able to help create a company that really embraces, you know, curiosity and investigation and all those types of things. You know, I would say that everything that we do as a company right now, you know, lives at this intersection between research and strategy, design and storytelling, purpose-driven places, and a real sense of, you know, belonging and vitality. And, you know, that's something that shows up regardless of who the client is, you know, whether we're working on an innovation campus, you know, or working with, you know, a philanthropic organization, or, you know, working with a tourist destination. And, you know, and so I think that, you know, the process that we use is something that allows us to be able to do this kind of work consistently, and almost everything that we do is heavily rooted in strategy. You know, so we'll do a deep dive, you know, looking at, you know, the product or service. We'll look at the consumers that we're looking to win and influence. We'll look at the competitive landscape, and then we look at culture and really what are some of the macro forces that are influencing how, where, and when decisions are being made. And the culmination of that is what we call the brand truth. And it's really sort of a positioning statement that's very, very short and isn't necessarily intended to go public, but can really help to inform everything that we do from there, whether that's naming, identity development, you know, developing an ad campaign, you know, web development, or anything else, you know. But so I think that those things certainly allow us to be able to do these things consistently, but, you know, but these are also things that I'm interested in personally as well. You know, I think I've probably gotten as much out of travel, or and particularly international travel, as I like that's had as big of an impact on my outlook as you know, any of my formal schooling, you know. And I think that one of the things that you realize when you move around is how many right ways there are to do the same thing.
Yes. Yeah.
And that has to make you, I think, both, you know, more creative, but I also think it makes you, you know, much more dexterous, you know, when it comes to culture, you know, in terms of being able to see points of connection, you know. And so I think that that's something that we're oftentimes trying to do, you know. And, you know, and I would say that, you know, the All-Inclusive Boston campaign in a lot of ways was, you know, something that I feel like, you know, we've been working towards for a really long time. You know, when I was in college, yeah, and my parents lived here in the 70s, and, you know, I came here in the very late 80s and, you know, into the early 90s. But, you know, whenever I would talk to them over the weekend, and before they would say goodbye, they would always say, love you and stay out of South Boston. Click.
That was the message every time you spoke to them. Yeah, as if you had forgotten from the last conversation.
Yes. You know, and so, like, that version of Boston doesn't really exist in the same ways anymore, right? And you know, and I think that you know, it's impossible for someone to not recognize that the city has become, you know, more diverse. I mean, there are 140 languages now spoken in the city of Boston, you know, that, you know, it's a majority minority city, or you look at sort of even just the composition of its Black population, or, you know, you look at how the city has become sort of, you know, much more of a cultural destination, that it's gotten hipper, that's got this vibrant culinary scene. When you look at the vibrancy of our LGBTQ plus communities, you know, a lot of what's happening with small business. Yeah, like I think there are a lot of things to look at with the city that that can create some optimism, you know, and I think that, you know, many of those things expand on a narrative of colonial history and tri-corner hats and, you know, academic institutions and, you know, the founding of the country, you know, and I think that those things, in fact, build on the founding of the country. You know, Boston's no stranger to demands for representation. And so if this is what Boston looks like today, you know, those things should show up in how we go to market.
Yeah, I think it is interesting because I think the Boston that you and I, because we're in the same era, the you and I came of age in, is definitely not the Boston that we're in now. I think there's some, you know, it's not perfect. And there's definitely a lot of challenges that still remain. I think there's a lot of work to still be done. But just in terms of space holding, like, I can name at least four full-blown festivals that, you know, at least four and probably more if I think about it, that are going on that are, you know, driven by Black communities or the diverse, and within that range of those festivals, you see the diversity of those communities, which I think is another one of our superpowers in terms of being a region. You know, we are the most diverse, the diverse Black population in a metro area in the country. You know, we have folks from the islands, we have folks from the continent, we have folks that from all over America that all are that are all here. And I think that when you're able to kind of draw on that kind of diversity, that only good things can come out of it.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Yeah, and ideally that we help to expand each other.
Yeah. Yeah, that and when you talk about that expansion, when you said expansion, it automatically made me think about something you had said earlier. When you were first getting into the design in the advertising space, you talked about how you kind of really didn't see yourself in those spaces or other people as well. What are some of the things that we can do or that can be done to kind of make that change? Because I, you know, obviously everybody can't go out and own their own company, and I would, you know, but there's got to be things that we can just be mindful of. Are those things that you consider as you operate and deal with building Proverb?
Yeah. So it's funny. When I think back to that time, and this may not come as much of a surprise to you, but like, I was really weird. Like, I was a weird Black guy. Do you know what I mean? Like,
Let's go with artistic, because most of my artistic friends dance to the beat of a different drum. Let's go with that.
Yeah, I mean, I was that, you know, and tall and skinny, and some people might even say aggressively tall and skinny, right? it was all of those things, you know what I mean? Like, on top of, you know, like going to, you know, art school or design school, on top of, you know, being interested in the things that you're interested in, you know? So like, I think that, you know, one of the things that we can do is to try to just create more room for each other. Like, I feel like that would really be helpful to everybody, you know, in terms of, you know, how we show up. And when I look at, you know, my kids' generation, you know, and I have two daughters who are 23 and 24, who, you know, are half Vietnamese, live in LA now, have an apartment together. Like, you know, like I look at sort of the track that that like they and their friends are on, you know, and it just feels like there's a lot of that. And I feel like that's kind of, you know, a lot of the schism that this country is facing at the moment. You know, it's between those forces, you know, forces towards something that's much more of a binary, you know, versus, you know, those who kind of want things to be able to, you know, grow and expand and, you know, and perhaps sort of create more options for ourselves.
Yeah. I think that, you know, it's, I always think about the, you know, so with at Embrace Boston, a piece of our work is in the arts and culture space. And one of the things I always think about is how to make the business of arts and culture more accessible for folks in the community that want to do it and need to do it right. I think that, you know, the arts is a weird thing because it's a unique thing rather in that once you demonstrate the skill, then kind of all these things that try to come around you and monetize it. But you, for your journey, you kind of took that on to yourself. And that is difficult for some artists. Some artists can't balance that, you know, putting your business hat on today, like what, and then putting your artistic hat on to the day afterwards. And it's, you know, that's difficult. How are you able to kind of strike that balance? Because I think that's essential for folks to hear, for folks in the creative world to hear.
Yeah. Well, you know, so I like food. Like I like to have
food. Okay. <in the refrigerator.
laughs> You know, and clothes. I like clothes. but I'm being a little bit flipped, but you know, like I've made so many mistakes, you know, and I grew up in a family that didn't talk about money, despite everything I told you. You know what I mean? Like we didn't talk about that, you know, and so there were just like so many things that you kind of have to figure out, you know. Like the first piece was, you know, after I left my job, like realizing that if I showed people my portfolio, like I got a different kind of response than talking to my boss, right? In terms of the value that I could create or what have you, you know, or then someone would then ask you, well, like, how much is this going to cost or whatever, you know? And I think that, you know, being able to, you know, to start to actually sort of look at, well, like, what are the mechanics of this? Like, how much do I actually need to make in order to be able to sustain myself? You know, sort of like, where is that revenue going to come from? You know, coming up with some numbers, practice the number. Someone advised me to do that. Like, figure out what your number is, say it in the mirror, get really comfortable with whatever your number is, you know, and, yeah, when you're trying to sell something, because like that's as much of the credibility as anything else, you know, saying to them, you know, I know you want us to do it for X, but here's what we need Y, right? And mm-hmm. And I think that kind of stuff can be really helpful. The second piece of it that I would recommend to anyone is there's an amazing Harvard Business School case study called Why Entrepreneurs Don't Scale. And it's available online. I don't think you even need to pay anything for it. But essentially what it says is that the set of skills that are required to start a business are completely different from the set of skills that are required to scale a business. And unless you're really committed to like learning and unlearning and learning some new stuff and unlearning that, like it's almost impossible to scale it into something that's bigger. And the way in which you might organize yourself if you're a company of three is different from the way in which you organize a company of 13 or a company of 300, you know. And so, you know, so I would say that that's something that I would recommend, you know, like figuring out like just some of the mechanics of business, you know. There's also a great book called Scaling Up, which is the Kellogg method, you know, and it's divided into like the, you know, four units of business, you know, so understanding HR, understanding operations, understanding finance, you know, and, you know, so on and so forth. And so like, I think that, you know, there are certainly a lot of tools out there to help you to get up to speed, but I would definitely get up to speed on on that piece of it, you know, because, you know, nothing kills small business faster than cash flow. And so you really need to understand the money as much as you understand anything else. You know, I would say that, you know, the other piece of it is, you know, particularly when you're starting out, like, and I didn't realize this until maybe like 5 or 7 years into it, that you could ask for help.
Mm.
And, you know, and you can even ask for help from people who've figured out how to do the thing that you're looking to do. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. someone who's already figured it out and say, you know, hey, I'd love to talk to you about like how you got from X to Y, or, you know, I'm struggling with this piece of it. Like, have you encountered that? You know, I think that most people generally like to think of themselves as good people and helpful, you know, and if you ask for help, you know, in my experience, you know, more often than not, you know, people tend to open up.
I mean, what, you know, I think you're probably the best person, one of the key people to ask this question. You know, I think for me, I think that the creative economy is one that gets looked over, but it's also probably the most vital. When you want to transform a neighborhood, you know, let the artist free in that neighborhood and it makes it interesting and now people want to come to it. If you want people to come to a destination, let there be art happening on a regular basis and people will come to it and that will revitalize that area. What are some of the things you think that we can do in the Boston area to kind of really support that creative economy and so that you're not alone? Like, I, you know, granted, it's great that you know, the proverb is doing well, and not to say that there are no other creative companies in the city, but kind of being in a ecosystem of all that going on allows for what you were discussing a second ago, which is the idea of having somebody to ask a question to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a few things. You know, if you think about it, you know, like anything that you put on, listen to, watch, mm-hmm. you know, sit in, drive around,
you're back.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like all of these things are created by artists and designers, right? Like our, so much of our world, and it's you know, in a lot of ways, you know, and certainly more and more, you know, when we look at, you know, how we just problem solve, you know, whether that's in business and science or what have you, in terms of, you know, looking at how we can, you know, apply design thinking, you know, so as much as we're talking about objects, we're also talking about sort of a framework in terms of how you actually problem solve. You know, I would say that the first piece of it is treating it seriously like any other industry, you know, and so in the same ways in which, you know, we make major investments in many other industries, I think that, you know, sort of looking at how we can create, you know, more support, you know, for the creative economy. I think that, you know, the more and more that we can do to actually sort of, you know, showcase, you know, and spotlight and just underscore the economic impact, you know, that these industries actually have, you know, I think the more likely we are to take them more seriously. You know, I would also say that, you know, in the same way in which we have, you know, incubators that are focused on science or that are focused on technology, you know, we should be doing that, you know, for the creative economy. And then lastly, I would say that I just think, you know, as a city, you know, given the schools, conservatories, and research institutions that we have, you know, whether we're talking about Berklee College of Music, Massachusetts College of Art and Design, Harvard's Graduate School of Design, MIT. I mean, like we've got, you know, New England Conservatory, BU. You know, we've got some of the most influential conservatories in the world, you know, and if you are sort of narrowing that out to, you know, things like modern music, you know, like unarguably, you know, and so to me, you know, Boston should feel more like Austin. Like, I don't understand why Boston doesn't have a more vibrant music scene. And, you know, and, you know, certainly, you know, when you look at, you know, the amount of talent that comes through here that, you know, that kind of uses Boston as its proving ground, you know, looking at how we can commercialize that seems like, you know, something that that many of us should give more attention.
Yeah, I think you're hitting it right there. I think that it's a concerted effort. And I think that, you know, we're fortunate, and I think that our current city administration is feeling and seeing that, because I'm watching some of the choices that they're making that are in that. But I, you know, I'm always rooting for the creators and rooting for the artists. So I want to see more. You know what I mean? I want to see more of that, because it's interesting you say Austin, because Austin is one of those cities that I think you're right. I think that Boston should feel a little bit more like Austin. Like, there, we should be one of those cities that people come to, and not just use it as a proving ground to go somewhere else, but, you know, to live and flourish with your creativity here. I went to visit Nashville last year, and I remember going in there, and I was like walking through the streets of Nashville, and I was like, this is probably one of the few places where you could be a working musician. Mm-hmm. Like Nashville and probably New Orleans are probably two of those cities where you can be a working musician, pay a mortgage, raise your kids, all that stuff, and not have to have a hit record or a record company, you know what I mean? Right. Or a record deal, right, or whatever.
Yeah, when also that there's you know, a knock-on effect, right, to having sort of you know, a culturally vibrant city. It makes it more attractive. It makes it a place that you want to live, or it makes it a place that you you know, want to locate your company, or any of those things, you know. And so, you know, we've seen it time and time again, you know, the ways in which, you know, you can use culture, you know, to shift a narrative, you know, or help drive competitiveness, you know, in locations where the story isn't so obvious, you know, or in cities, you know, that, you know, have experienced a lot of challenges, you know, and so to me, you know, it feels like, you know, one of the tools, you know, that could really be utilized to help make, you know, more of the region, you know, more vibrant.
Yeah, and but I think that we're starting, or at least maybe this is the eternal optimist in me. I'm hoping that we're going in that direction to see more of that. And I think that, you know, one of the unique opportunities that the aftermath of the pandemic presents us with is, how do you revitalize like your downtown area when people don't have to go downtown to work anymore? You know, when we're living in a hybrid world, you know, the first thing I think of is, you know, us as artists. Like, look at Brooklyn. The areas of Brooklyn that people love to be in now were some of the worst parts of the city, and the artists get in there and kaboom.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that, you know, increasingly, and, you know, and part of this is about, you know, the role of the office, you know, and the office being less and less of an obligation and much more of a destination. Right. And, you know, and I think that, you know, certainly, you know, both, you know, landlords, property managers, you know, and companies are really looking at, you know, how you can sort of make that experience into something that is much more high quality, you know, and that the office is less about being a container for work, yeah, and much more of a tool, right? In terms of, you know, looking at, you know, how people can make the most of the time that they're together. I think that there's a lot of overlap between what's happening with office with what's happening in downtowns. Particularly, when we have, a lot of the ground floor, and I tend to think about, retail space as part of the ground plane or part of the public realm in the same way that I think about parks or sidewalks, that like retail is a big part of the identity of, of a particular location, and so I think that, while there are challenges, there's also a big opportunity for, some of these neighborhoods to really sort of shape what they want to be about and what they want to see more of, and so whether that is, through art, through culture, through, retail, or any other type of use, but certainly, retail spaces, feel like a big part. A big opportunity there. Certainly public art is a big opportunity there. And obviously there are others. So.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that is a key part of it. And I'm hoping for the best for us going forward. I think we're a city, and I definitely think that with people like you in leadership positions, I'm waiting for you to run and become the head of arts and culture for the city of Boston. Many years from now, when Kara is going on, you could take that on as one of the many roles that you have. If you're up to it, if you feel like you could be in the public sector.
Oh, I think I've got way too much dirt.
that's one of the things I think about as well. I'm not sure if I'm ready to go into public life and do those things as well. But I appreciate, even with your soiled reputation that you've been able to be, that you've been able to be a guest with us today, man. I thank you so much for sharing your journey, and I can't wait to see what else Proverb builds and creates. I will say that you and Proverb have got me interested in vacationing in Bermuda. When I spoke to you one time and you told me it was like 2 hours away, right?
Yeah.
It's 2 or 3 hours away.
Ninety minutes. It's even less.
So if I can, that's quicker. That's a little bit like going to DC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in the time that I can go to DC, I can go to Bermuda. Oh man, listen. And DC is wonderful, but it doesn't have, sand and beaches and tropical drinks all together.
Yeah, I mean, so it's interesting, and I know that we're winding down, but when the Bermuda Tourism Authority came to us, mm-hmm. that was the question, right? They wanted to know, to what degree proximity and that story of 90 minutes should be central to the marketing, and we said, yes, absolutely. But we also went off and did a lot of primary research and a lot of thinking. And what we came back to them with was that, while we think proximity is central, we think that there are even better reasons to go to Bermuda and additional levers, that we could pull on. And, and one of the ways in which we thought about the proximity story was that, it's really tied to your ability to be, convenient and attractive. And there are other places that you can get to that feel about as far away, in 90 minutes, and they're not to the south, they're to the north. we said, Montreal feels as far away as Bermuda probably does, right? And they've got even worse weather, and they've figured it out, right? And so what we really tried to do was to push the marketing in a direction of Bermuda as a cultural destination. Bermuda is an interesting place because Bermudians are oftentimes having as good a time, if not a better time, than the tourists are. And that doesn't happen very often in the places that it's sometimes compared to. It doesn't happen with the same frequency in, you know, a lot of the Caribbean or parts of Mexico or things along those lines. And so the campaign really tries to center Bermudians and Bermuda knowledge, you know, and really looking at how Bermudians can share what they love about where they live. And, you know, and so Lost Yet Found is really an opportunity to encourage people to come to the island, to get off the beaten path, you know, and when they are lost, you know, that there's a, you know, a warm and welcoming community there to receive them.
And as a Bermudian, I know that must have been super a wonderful kind of feeling to be able to contribute back to the island in that way with that campaign once you got the ability to do it.
Oh yeah, it's such an honor. Yeah. So
I mean, do they have so they greet you when you come to the airport like a returning soldier? Do they is that how they when you get off the plane?
No. Bermuda's a funny place, so yeah, there's none of that.
Because I was gonna go down there and tell them I know you. See what I mean? See if I get the VIP treatment.
Yeah. So. But yeah, you know, and it's been really effective campaign in terms of both, you know, supporting their recovery, but also, you know, creating a new brand promise, you know, that the island can grow into for some time, and to, you know, and to really sort of present something that I think. You know, make sense for where we are today. So
you know, I know you got to go because you're a busy man doing busy people stuff. But what do you got coming up for Proverb in the future? What is the next big challenge? It feels like you're rising to the occasion. Just keep knocking these things out. What is the next big thing for you?
Yeah, I mean, so we're working on a bunch of things. So the commercial real estate work we do, you know, that's really a national practice. You know, so we do as much, you know, outside of Massachusetts as we do here locally. So right now we're working on a large innovation campus in Tampa at the Moffitt Center, which is, the fourth largest cancer hospital in the country. You know, we've also been working on Dorchester Bay City, which is, you know, about a third of the size of the seaport, you know, that'll be on the waterfront there in a really, really interesting project. You know, we're, you know, about to launch the Mass Humanities rebrand. So that's something that's coming up. We're also working with New England Aquarium right now to help them to reposition themselves to be seen as much more of an ocean conservation organization, you know, and an agent in the fight against climate change, you know, and not just a place that sells ticketed events and things along those lines. And a number of other things, you know. So we're really, really excited. You know, it feels like we've had some good fortune. We've got a killer team. We've got the best Proverb team I think we've ever had. You know, and so yeah, I'm excited, you know, about you know where I think we can go to from here.
Okay, that's incredible to hear. Thank you so much. Oh, one last question. So I ask everybody, this is my new thing I've been doing. I've been asking everybody who comes on Good Trouble, because I feel like all good troublemakers know other people who are good troublemakers. Who is the next person you think we should have on the show to talk about their journey and that could be giving some good information to folks?
Oh, Kirk Sykes.
Kirk Sykes?
Yeah, of Accordia Partners. And Kirk has just, he's someone I would describe as a polymath and, you know, was, you know, I think one of the first, if not the first, like professional Black downhill skiers, you know, was a trained architect, raised a fund where he would deploy capital, used to chair the Federal Reserve. He's become a commercial real estate developer. He's the developer behind Dorchester Bay City. He's doing a lot of work focused on, sort of equity and trying to create opportunities, you know, for more folks, to be able to participate, in institutional grade deals. He's also a cyclist, races Porsches. I mean, like, he's just an interesting dude. And
this just sounds like James Bond. This is just, you know what I mean?
He's close.
So I know I've heard his name, seen him around, had no idea all the stuff was going on. So you're right. It sounds exactly like the kind of person that we need to talk to and learn more about his story. But today we had the pleasure of learning about your story, and I appreciate you so much for coming on the show, man. Thank you so much.
Awesome. No, thank you, Greg. This was such a treat.
We had a good time for the second time in a row. It worked out pretty good.